This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Canary. Later this hour, we're going to talk with Sarah Owen. She's president and CEO of the Southwest Florida Community Foundation, about the foundation's new workplace in downtown Fort Myers that it calls the Collaboratory, which is in what used to be the Atlantic Coast Line Railway Depot. We're also going to hear about a new play being performed by the at the Collaboratory, that is, later this month. It's the latest site-specific production by Ghostbird Theater Company. We'll chat with the play's writer and director, as well as one of the show's lead actors. But first, we're going back in time to the early 1920s when the Atlantic Coast Line Railway Depot was first being built. The city of Fort Myers had about 8,000 residents at the time. Thomas Edison was still alive and had been wintering in the city for decades, and Henry Ford had built his winter residence here about a decade prior. The Railway Depot's construction was a leap forward for the city and marked the beginning of a growth period. Its Spanish mission-style facade was a regular feature downtown, and it was a hub for the community. But it was also a strong symbol of the racial segregation of the time, with separate waiting rooms, bathrooms, and boarding platforms. And despite the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which banned segregation in public places, passengers continued to be separated by race for boarding at the depot all the way up until it closed in 1971. To learn more about its past, I'm joined by Jim Powers. He's the historian at the IMAG History and Science Center in downtown Fort Myers. Jim, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Well, thank you, Mike. Always glad to be here.
It's always nice to have you. And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So this was not the city's first train depot, correct? There was something happening train-wise prior to this. What was going on?
Well, the railroad crossed the Caloosahatchee River in 1904, and that in itself was a whole long story,
right,
having to do with the plant empire. And, you know, if you think about the two railroads, you think about the East Coast, Henry Flagler.
Mm-hmm.
The West Coast is Henry Plant.
Okay.
And both, of course, were Rockefeller associates.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of a closed business. But anyhow, the Atlantic Coastline Railroad crossed over Beautiful Island. Now, if you want to know where Beautiful Island is, for those of you who are not boaters, it's right under I-75. And then it proceeded along the south bank of the Caloosahatchee until it got to downtown Fort Myers. It got to what is known as Monroe Street today, mm-hmm. and then it headed back north, straight down the middle of Monroe Street.
Hmm.
And at the end...
So this was the last stop.
Yeah, and at the end, it was a pier. And the whole idea was to connect up with the steamboat franchises owned by the railroad and owned by Collier, so on and so forth, later on. And the passenger station was a wooden station built on the in the middle of Monroe Street.
And so how much of an upgrade was this new facility, the new building that's downtown that
we're
talking about now?
It cost $110,000, which was a tremendous amount of money at the time, to build this new station. But they were in a period of rapid growth and a great deal of conflict. The community had just when the construction began, Collier, Lee, and Hendry are all the same. Mm-hmm. They're all Lee County.
Right, right.
And it splits in 1923,
okay,
almost coexisting, but a little before the structure is built. And the really, really primary reasons for the segregation is that, or the separation better, that politics, they just could not get along. Eastern Lee County against Eastern Lee County against Southern Lee County. And that's why we basically ended up with three counties.
Oh, really? Hmm. What were they fighting over?
They were fighting over just about everything you could think of. But the primary one was the Dixie Highway proposal versus the Tamiami Trail.
I was going to ask you about that, because Tamiami Trail is not a thing yet.
Yeah, that's correct. And what you have to know is you've got fights like the border trade. Now, the border trade is for the Dixie Highway, because its sponsors are those people in the eastern county, what is now Hendry. And the Tamiami Trail, of course, is sponsored by the people who are on the west coast all the way down.
So this was a fight over how things should develop.
Absolutely.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, tell me about it. And we're on about our third or fourth form of government by then, local government anyhow.
How did the idea to build the train station happen? Is it a city reached out, or did the railroad reach out, or, you know, what was the origin story?
Well, it's kind of interesting when you put all the background together. I researched, obviously, for the years that I was there, off and on, about where I am. I'm sitting in the middle of this train station. And I got a lot of facts, but I could never pull government documents. And then I found out why. Because railroads were totally exempt from any regulation by localities.
Oh, so there were no records, because why keep records on something you had no say over?
That's correct.
Well, isn't that interesting?
It was built with no building permits. Its location was chosen, of course, by several other factors, ease, and they already had a yard. And it was serving a lot of lumber companies and so forth, and it was serving the power, light, and ice and so forth. And so it was central to that. But one of the interesting things was when you see a picture of the old depot, you'll always see a 50,000-gallon tower, water tower, next to it that doesn't belong to the railroad. It's the city's,
okay.
And it was built in 1910 over a well field that was supplying the city's water. They had 8 or 9 well heads at 900 feet deep, and the railroad needed lots of water.
Right, so that's sort of why they put it where they put it?
Exactly, in relationship to the yard in downtown.
Paint a picture of what Fort Myers looked like in 1924, like downtown. I mean, were there
more of the conflict. You have the progressives that want lots of bonds to make lots of municipal improvements. You have the No High Tax League leading the way against any improvements. This all ties in with the Tamiami and Dixie. This ties in with who's elected to go to the legislature. This ties into ever so many different things. But there's a tremendous amount of conflict going on. So it's an entrepreneurial thing. It's the railroad's decision.
Culturally, Fort Myers, about 8,000 people at the time, I think.
In rough terms.
Yeah. And how far did it stretch geographically?
Well, it doesn't go much past
like the Edison Estate.
Actually, you know how accurate you really are.
That was an educated guess.
Yeah, and it doesn't go very much past Billy's Creek.
Right, yeah. Well, my house was built in 1924, and I'm just out there past Billy Creek, so that's probably, you know, one of the first houses in that area at the time.
Yeah, I mean, there were lots of subdivisions. I mean, we're in the land boom.
Right.
So there are lots of subdivisions, but people don't realize that they had yet to be incorporated into the city proper.
Now, this building was built with segregation in the blueprints, right?
Absolutely. So was everything south of Washington, D.C.
Right.
The Coastline's headquarters was in Wilmington, North Carolina, at the time.
And then, the Atlantic Coast Railway,
And then it moved to Richmond and then ultimately to Jacksonville with consolidation with the Seaboard Airline Railroad in 1963. But the plans for the station, for a depot, are not local. They're based on what corporate headquarters has on file.
I see.
Now, an architect, chief architect by the name of Griffin, was head of had that responsibility for the Atlantic Coastline Railroad. There was a standard set of blueprints for size of population served, anticipated growth, locality in accordance with hot or cold or mild climates and
sure,
so forth.
Sure.
The particular blueprint that was brought here to do this station that opened in 1924 was the same blueprint used to build the station in Sarasota, which has subsequently been raised, but we're it right now. And thank you, Foundation. Community Foundation has done a marvelous, marvelous job. That's something that everyone listening to us should be exceptionally proud of. Hmm.
We'll talk a little bit more about how the building was laid out. I've been there. I've gotten the tour. But when you see it, it's a stark reminder.
Yeah, it was laid out from east to west. That was its axis. And it was on Peck Street, which no longer technically exists anywhere. And it's only a block and a half south of Martin Luther King presently, with an entrance on Jackson Street. And it was built as a – think of it this way, Mike. It's a large tent, and inside that tent are three buildings. There is a building on the western end that was labeled white only. There was a building on the eastern end labeled colored only. And the center building was the railroad's property with ticket sales, Pullman sales, railroad staffing, train master, so on and so forth. It was two stories high. And there was a barricade inside that tent from the railroad's property north and south to segregate the two sides.
And there were four bathrooms?
Four bathrooms, yeah, sure.
Separate waiting rooms, the whole
that's
deal.
That's right.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Jim Powers. He's the historian at the IMAG History and Science Center in downtown Fort Myers. We're learning about the history of the train depot in downtown Fort Myers that is now the Southwest Florida Community Foundation's new home base. If you'd like to ask him a question or make a comment, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we are at WGCU. Just use the hashtag GCL. So in 1957, they reduced the side of some changes were made in 1957.
Yeah,
can you characterize that?
Sure, I can characterize
it. And the why behind it, I guess?
I can really do that. It's called competition. And it's interesting because in 1927, the Seaboard Airline Railroad had 5,000 miles of trackage, and the coastline had 5,000 miles of trackage. And many places in the deep south, they would run as much as 100 miles within 50 feet of each other almost.
Really?
They're totally parallel trackage everywhere you ever wanted to go. They were real competitors. And so the Seaboard comes here. And so that whole environment started to expand. The railroad went all the way to Everglades City at one time, the capabilities. The Seaboard ran spurs to Iona and Punta Raza and to La Belle to pick up business. The Seaboard realized in early 1950s and moved in the 1955-56 era, ripping up all their own track, that there was not enough money to be made in Southwest Florida, that left the Atlantic coastline here single service. It was a dwindling passenger service on top of the freight economy, because now you're into trucking, vegetable trucking. You know, the truck farms around here were just
Interstate highway system wasn't built in 57, was it?
Was it Eisenhower? You got
I'm trying
the,
to,
but it
hadn't
completed
made it here.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, so the issue was they pulled the Seaboard airline pulled out. And the ACL's passenger service started to diminish. So the less frequent of the travelers, which was the colored community, that colored waiting room was divided, cut in half, made into other purposes and so forth.
Gotcha.
So, and the other thing, Mike, is when they built the building, the interior of the Sarasota building and the interior of the Fort Myers Depot, the blueprints were guidelines. The local contractor and the local yardmaster, train master, so on and so forth, made the decisions about what they were going to do inside. And as a consequence, the train station here had two fireplaces, two large fireplaces. And so there were a lot of differences in the interior construction of the two. Generally, it was the same blueprint, but the details were quite different.
So in the short video that the Community Foundation put together, which, by the way, you can find on our website, it's on their website. We also have it with this web post at WGCU.org. You said that they were still boarding by race all the way up till 1971.
That's correct. Voluntarily.
Voluntary. Right. How much of an outlier was that for a southern Florida city for that to still be happening, you know, 7 years after the Civil Rights Act?
I don't think it's any different anywhere in the South at the time. It was a great deal of reluctance to make that transition. Shame on us, but that's the way it was. It was an inroad into 200 years of history.
You know, during that video about the depot, which features you and Jarrett Eady from the Lee County Black History Society, who we tried to get on the show today, he couldn't make it, but we wish we could have. We'll try to get him on in the future. I bring him up because in that video, he seemed a bit like taken aback when you were talking about that still being the case in the 1970s. Let's hear a little bit of that audio now.
In the 1970s, there was still boarding by race in groups
and
in the 1970s. Closed in 71, that was the last train, but nonetheless, it wasn't, of course, by law, it was by habit.
But having the awareness and being able to tell the story, so we talk about 1971, there are a lot of citizens who still have recollection of the train, of the railroad tracks.
Yes.
Going back and looking at historical anecdotal information connected to the lynching around 1924,
right.
We know that the story tells us that those young men who were killed, lynched, not above the age 16, young man was actually found sleeping in a train, sleeping in the cargo train,
exactly.
And was turned into his captors.
Right.
So the story of the trains have always had a connection. I ask you a question about Slater. My great-grandfather came from the middle part of South Carolina, hopped on a train and came down here and ended up at Slater and stayed there before he came over to the Safety Hill, which eventually became Dunbar Community.
Right.
So I think that if you look at the African-American experience and the diaspora and the Great Migration, trains and transportation have always been a way to find a better life, to find a more opportunity. And it's unfortunate because of Jim Crow law and because of segregation laws that were the law of the land, that some of that opportunity was diminished because of these laws that were codified on the book. And to show that until 1971, there were things that were in place that made it not inclusive. Although we were a diverse community, we were not an inclusive community. So it shows us that we still have lots of work to do.
You know, the Fort Myers-Dunbar community sort of begins literally right on the other side of the tracks. And that's sort of it's not a cliche, it's a historical reference. Can you reflect on that as it was in Fort Myers and just nationwide? It's interesting, like he just pointed to the idea of what a railroad represents in terms of connecting people was also this great symbol of disconnecting people.
Jarrett is a very, very articulate and smart person, and I agree with every one of his comments. I mean, it comes to mind immediately. The transportation is connected to change in the South, especially. The influx of farm labor. If you think about it, before the train got here, if our ancestors had attempted to market large quantities of products, they had only either almost non-existent roads or water paths, one or the other, all of which were very slow. Second, 1904, when the train comes, you can grow grove after grove. You can grow field after field of tomatoes or whatever. And you can ship them quickly. Within 36 hours, you're in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And you need labor now. Our black population was, and Mike, this is hard for some people to understand. The 1860 census, just before the outbreak of the American Civil War, shows that from Point Roman north, that includes all of us, there were 16 blacks on the United States government census.
Hmm.
When the railroad and our primary occupation, cattle raising. Well, there weren't a great deal of slaves associated with cattle raising.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a totally different attitude here, too, as we didn't actually want a war. If you went to war, you'd come back and you have no cattle, no family, and no land.
Hmm.
So there were very few African Americans here. There were a great many in Key West, which is a county seat. But until that railroad crossing, those iron rails spurred that commerce on and allowed for quick shipping, we were stagnant or partially stagnant. And that brought a great deal of our African-American citizens here for a better life to try another opportunity. And Jarrett couldn't have been more correct. They ran into the same traditions, quote, unquote. And that's if you go back to the 1971 closure when blacks were coming into one side of the station or another side of the station and boarding a particular car or not a particular car and so forth, it was the reluctance to trample on, which should have been done, the traditions.
Hmm. What do you think people in the 1920s or 30s or 40s would think about what the depot has become today, which is the opposite of a symbol of segregation? It is a symbol of integration.
Well, once again, I could never think like that, but I'll answer what I think, and that is they would be not so happy.
Hmm. Hmm. Well, any final thoughts, Jim? We're going to take a break so we can talk about the future of this building.
Only that it's a fantastic reuse of a train station and the community foundation. I can't say enough about what they've accomplished and, frankly, what they hope to accomplish.
Hmm. That is all the time we have for this part of the show. I want to thank my guest. Jim Powers is the historian at the IMAG History and Science Center in downtown Fort Myers. Jim, thanks for your time and historical insights as always.
Thank you, Mike.
When we return, we're sitting down with the president and CEO of the Southwest Florida Community Foundation to get a sense of what's happening at the train depot now and what the future might hold. I'm Mike Kniry. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.